Monster Man, Episode 112, Kargra to Kuotoa. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're taking a look at some more K monsters from the Fiend Folio, the 1981 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. Before we do that, though, I want to quickly respond to some listener mail. I got some posts on Patreon in response to recent episodes. Sebastian Wakely, who's really been teaching me a lot about the history of these monsters, who knows a lot more than I do about kind of early modules and so on, and he said, "Hi, James. Listening to your episode today prompted me to compare the versions of the Kelpie in S2 and the Fiend Folio. S2 is the scenario White Plume Mountain, and it was written by the creator of the Kelpie, Lawrence Schick. And he was saying that the Fiend Folio version has both the female and equine versions, which is consistent with the Scottish folktales, whereas the original in S2 is only capable of imitating a woman. And I would say that the horse form is one of the distinctive features of the Kelpie, so I think that that's a notable addition. And then he says, I wonder if Don Turnbull added the British color or Lawrence Schick expanded his own creation. And it is interesting that the mention of the horse form is very, very brief. So if we want to believe that Don Turnbull like just inserted it, it's just a little parenthetical. So that's actually completely possible. Good eye. Next, we have a comment from Robert Gordon, who had some thoughts on the Kamadan. And he says, I wanted to share an idea that plays upon your thoughts on how the Kamadan is a tactically interesting enemy in which positioning and teamwork are both important, when really this is not the case with a lot of other monsters from the book. I mean, I want to interject and say it is, it just doesn't seem to be part of their design per se. So like, a goblin poses the same tactical challenges that, say, a person would. I think that the early mid AD&D period was a time in which there was a pretty big rift in the player base between groups that played with miniatures and groups that played without them. Monsters like this one, in which positioning and grouping are both interesting and important, likely come from people who did use miniatures. Mind you, I didn't actually start playing for a few years after this, but that argument, imagination versus representation, was still burning between people I played with who had been playing since the early 80s. I think it's one of the back-and-forth struggles which has defined the different iterations of D&D. I think that's true to some extent. It certainly was a complaint about 3rd edition that it's very positional, combat visualization was so important in 3rd edition combat that many people claimed that it almost required using miniatures. But on the other hand, lots of people played it without. So people often like to point to the complexity of D&D's rules as a reason that it has its roots in wargaming. But in my experience, these are mostly people that don't play very many war games whose rules tend not to be that complicated. Certainly not as complex as D&D. So yeah, I think that might be true. Although, I mean, again, then I don't know where the Kamadan comes from, right? It's not inspired by a miniature, so presumably somebody took a leopard toy and some snake toys and got gluing. Okay, speaking of weird monsters, and speaking of Lawrence Schick, let's start with today's first monster, the Kargra, created by Lawrence Schick. The Kargra is really interesting. It's a freakish kind of, it's sort of fish-like. It's not really a fish. It's from the elemental plane of Earth, and it swims through solid rock. And they breach out of the rock, right? Like, you might get attacked by them. They would splash out of the wall of a cavern or something. And they eat metal. So they're always looking for, they sort of are metal, and they eat metal. And they're always looking for shiny metal objects to eat, like, say, your weapons and armor. And says they're very seldom found outside the elemental plane of Earth itself. Now, in its design, it seems to me that the Kargra is very similar to the Zorn. By which I don't mean that they look alike, but they do have the same thing of having radial symmetry, which gives them a more alien appearance, as H.P. Lovecraft would know, and also looking for minerals, right? So Zorns are looking for gems, and Kargra are looking for metal. But this does address the question of why the Zorn is even on the prime material plane at all, right? I mean, if you want to just eat minerals, and you're from the elemental plane of Earth, it seems like the elemental plane of Earth is an excellent place for you to stay. And as for Kargra, it's like, yeah, they actually don't really leave the elemental plane of Earth very much. To me, the Kargra seems a little bit like a more fully developed Zorn. You know, Lawrence Schick has clearly sort of taken the basic idea of the Zorn and put some thought into saying, well, what would a creature of the elemental plane of Earth be like, right? It would be able to just move through Earth. You know, Earth would be the environment in which it lived. And you can deal with the Kargra by thinking about it as a creature that is made of metal. So, for example, if you cast heat metal on it, it takes a bunch of damage, but most other fire spells don't affect it very much. So basically, there are things where it kind of has this puzzle aspect, but a puzzle aspect that comes from observing details about the monster and just making inferences based on them, which is always nice. So I feel like this is basically like a more thought through, more refined, somewhat better executed of a version of a concept that we saw in the Monster Manual. I really like the Kargra. I don't know where they come up in a game. Like, they lose a lot of their fun as a random encounter because they're so weird that when they show up with their, like, freakish appearance and everything, there has to be this sense of, like, what's going on here? You know, something is very wrong. These creatures from the elemental plane of Earth should not be here. Unless, of course, you're on the elemental plane of Earth yourself, in which case we are trying to present an environment that seems really strange, which is a good thing. Next on our list is the Kilmulis, and this was written by Gary Gygax. The Kilmulis is a creature from Scottish and Borders, that is like the area along the Scottish-English border folklore. And in folklore, the Kilmulis is a little goblin kind of creature that often hangs around in kilns. I don't mean pottery kilns. I mean kilns used to process oats. At least I think that's what they're talking about, because another thing that the Kilmulis might do is mix ashes in among your oats. So I assume that we're talking about the, you know, once you've hulled oats, the inner kernel is then heated, and that would happen in this kiln. And I assume they're quite fine and sort of powdery, so getting ashes mixed in there, like if you had to remove them, it'd be a real pain in the neck. And yet, presumably, there would be a lot of ashes around, this being a fire-heated kiln. So the Kilmulis is another kind of domestic gremlin or pixie. They're not dangerous, they're just kind of mischievous. And they're sometimes represented, you know, some sources say they have no mouth, and the Kilmulis in Dungeons & Dragons also has no mouth. It basically has like a sort of trunk-like nose that it uses to hoover up food. So basically, this is another little kind of house brownie creature. It's not super obvious what the Kilmulis is for in a game, but I think it would be fun to have as like a witness in something. You know, it's just kind of there to assert that you're in a very heavily magical world. You know, oh, we found the miller dead by the oat kiln. Well, you know, maybe, hey, you know, Kilmulises sometimes live in the, maybe we can find it and it can tell us something about what it saw or something like that. Or, you know, maybe something bad is happening and people are just kind of like, oh yeah, it must be a Kilmulis like playing tricks again. Yeah. So this is another one of those kind of fairy tale creatures, maybe not super consequential. Obviously, you're not going to like run into a Kilmulis in a dungeon and have a fight with it, but kind of an interesting addition to like a village or town setting. You might want to be a little cautious with this. One of the sort of recurring tropes of older D&D is that urban and sort of domestic environments are less magical than wildernessy ones, right? That there's civilization here and danger out there. And later editions kind of sort of downplay that by putting a lot of magical stuff very openly in their home settings. You know, there are all kinds of like, oh, this is a dragonborn that runs a tavern and so forth, right? That these things aren't exotic. They're just a feature of the setting. And maybe the Kilmulis does that, but I don't think so, actually. I don't know. I like the idea that all these things that people in the real world sort of told stories about and maybe even believed in, the difference in D&D is that they're actually just real. Okay, and finally we come to the Kuo-Toa. Now, the Kuo-Toa are sort of a race of fishmen, and they live in what this book describes as the underworld, which I guess is what today would be referred to as the Underdark. That is to say, a sort of connected network of caverns and tunnels and subterranean cities and so on that underlie the implied D&D setting. They were first introduced in module D2, Shrine of the Kuo-Toa, which is a sequel to a module that I mentioned recently, A Descent into the Depths of the Earth, which is the first module that has the Germlin in it. And the Kuo-Toa also show up in the one that follows that, which is Vault of the Drow, I want to say. Anyway, so the Kuo-Toa are among these races that kind of inhabit the Underdark and have these conflicts with each other. So, you know, we've talked about the Mind Flayers, we've talked about the Githyanki, the Drow are another one, and so on. And this idea of the competing factions of the Underdark is going to go on to become a very important feature in Dungeons & Dragons kind of lore, and I think partly, you know, nowadays, there are lots of scenarios published focusing on it, but I think that this is where it comes from, is the kind of campaign that goes from the Giants scenarios to Queen of the Demon Web Pits. And I do think that the interesting thing about, so initially I was like, there's a lot of fish people in this game. What's the difference between a Kuo-Toa and a Sahuagin? The interesting thing is that the Kuo-Toa, for all their fishiness, aren't really that aquatic. You know, Sahuagin and Lokotha are sea creatures. They exist in kind of coastal and maritime environments. You know, there's going to be like a lonely old fishing village that is under a siege by the Lokotha or whatever. By contrast, the Kuo-Toa are underworld denizens, and their fishiness is kind of secondary to them, I guess? Some have said that the Kuo-Toa are inspired by the Deep Ones from the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Shadow Over Innsmouth, and I guess I can sort of see it, the idea of them having, like, shrines and temples and doing religious rituals, and that all being very important to them. I guess that kind of ties into the Deep Ones, but it's a similarity that is, to some degree, just like, oh, well, they're fish guys. Subsequent iterations of the game have tried to make the Kuo-Toa more Deep One-like to kind of capitalize on their popularity as a horror monster, and maybe they are directly inspired by the Deep Ones, but, you know, it's just kind of curious that they're among the few fishy guys whose whole thing isn't just being fishy guys, which I think is quite interesting. And of course they have this sort of almost Morlock-like thing where they once had like a big empire above ground and they were forced underground by, you know, the alliances of humans and elves, and they basically sit down there nursing their grudges and, you know, developing secret resentments, which I think is very much in keeping with the idea of an underworld. It's really interesting that the Underdark, which is a copyrightable term, I guess, came to be the approved term, because it seems to me that underworld shares a bunch of associations that are all kind of appropriate to the Kuo-Toa, so obviously it's an underworld in that it's, you know, a world beneath the regular world. But also, underworld has implications of criminal activity and of death, right? Like the underworld in the sense of where dead people go when they die. So it's a word with many meanings. And I think all of those are appropriate for the sense of sinister mystery that's meant to be associated with the Kuo-Toa at this point. So initially I was kind of inclined to dismiss the Kuo-Toa as not being that different from the many other species of aquatic or fish-like humanoids that we've encountered so far in the monster books, but actually I think that maybe because they come from a scenario and therefore they have a sort of existing context, they work as distinct things. I often wonder, you know, to what extent the Monster Manual, to some extent, I think, was an attempt to kind of collate creatures that had appeared in a variety of different places, and it revealed somewhat anyway the fact that there were kind of multiple individuals or teams working on their own things. So I often wonder if, like, things that are very different from each other in, like, the Monster Manual frequently has instances where there are multiple monsters that are quite similar to each other, and I always wonder, like, oh, is this, you know, is one of these, you know, one DM's creation and the other another DM's creation, and they both wound up in scenarios that those guys were writing, and then they just put them all in the same book. Something like that, anyway. And I do think, you know, that if there had been a, like, unified creative effort at the beginning, there wouldn't necessarily have been Kuo-Toa, they would have wound up being Sahuagin, but, you know, Gygax would prefer to just make up his own thing. And fair enough, I like the Kuo-Toa, and I'd rather not be without them. So yeah, overall, anyway, the Kuo-Toa work. And they work largely because fish guys tend to work. There's something wrong about them, right? Like, fish aren't frightening. If anything, I guess they're sad and mysterious. And that sort of fits in with the Kuo-Toa, who are less a, you know, direct physical threat, and more a, you know, sad conspiracy of some kind. Okay, that's about all the time that we have for today, and that's the last monster in the K chapter. So please join me next time as we get started on the L section of the Fiendfolio on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.